Welcome to Ants, Humans, Stars. I'm Digo, Digital Nomad, and I'm here with my very special podcast partner, Caleb.
An artist with a story to tell. Still telling stories.
Still telling stories. That's what we love to do. It's a podcast.
We are educating the masses.
We tell true crime and music history. I do the true crime. Caleb does the music history.
And we're keeping you entertained.
Exactly. Today, I'm back to true crime, and Caleb has some music history. I don't know what it is. We'll get to it later. You probably don't already know what it is because it's on the title of this podcast episode, but I don't know right now. Caleb will come back later after I tell you a little bit about people going missing, people of color going missing, and a little bit of true crime here. From Massachusetts, I pulled from an article from the Patriot Ledger, which is a morning newspaper printed in Quincy, Massachusetts. And okay. This article is by Jessica Hill, and it's titled "Why People of Color Get Less Attention Than Whites When They Go Missing."
Interesting. Okay, I'm looking forward to hearing this because those of us people of color know that, yes, this is the case.
When friends and family fail to hear from Jalia Finclair a day after she went missing, they contacted police and media outlets, anybody who could help spread the word and help find her. Finclair, a pregnant 18-year-old member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, was last seen on October 20th, that's October 20th, 2020, getting into a car with Luis Sargoza, on Cogshell Street in New Bedford, Massachusetts. After more than a month of interstate investigations by police in New Bedford, Mashpee, and Florida, Finclair's body with two shotgun wounds was found in a field off of Route 95 in Felsmere, Florida. Her death was ruled as a homicide, and Zaragoza, her suspected killer, died in a police shootout. Finclair's story, although terrible, heart-wrenching, it offered closure to her family, friends, and tribal community so they could heal. But her case is the exception, not the rule. For many families whose missing loved ones is a person of color, the opportunity for closure is rare. Weymouth Angel Vieira, 14, was last seen December 22nd, 2020. Donald Sampson was reported missing by his sister in Randolph 10 years ago and hasn't been found. Kenzie Diaz Zigakwe, who would now be 20, has been missing from Attleboro since November 16th, 2017. In Quincy, Hispanic 17-year-old Max Burley Zapata went missing in June. She was found shortly thereafter. Missing person cases involving people of color in the U.S. are less likely to be solved compared with cases involving white people. Additionally, the number of missing people of color is disproportionately higher, and their stories are often underrepresented in national conversations and mainstream media, according to the Black and Missing Foundation, a nonprofit organization that raises awareness and about missing people of color across the country. Before she was found, Finclair was the fifth missing woman of color in Massachusetts, reported to the foundation's website, joining the unsolved disappearances of Lisa Levette Hall, Rosa Ramos, Savannah Whitney Canada, and Jennifer Kabura Megua. Another Native American woman, Mikili Driver, who lived in Mashpee for about 8 years, went missing in November during a visit with her mother in Portland, Oregon. She has yet to be found. Our women and girls are treated much like our Mother Earth, said Jessie Little Doe Bayard, the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Council vice chair. She said in a statement, "They're stolen, violated, with very few giving voice to either the occurrence or the expressing of any outrage or solutions." Of all missing persons recorded in the U.S. in 2019, 33.7% were black, 59% were white and Hispanic Latino, according to the National Crime Foundation Center within the FBI. A total of 205,000 black people and over 359,000 white people, including Hispanic Latino, went missing last year. A note that the FBI counts white and Hispanic people together. 2017, Native American women represented 0.7%, 633 to be exact, of the FBI's missing persons cases. For comparison, 13.4% of national population is black, while 60% of it is white, 18% is Hispanic Latino, and 2.4% is Native American, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. It's high.
Yeah.
It's really high. Black women make up fewer than 77% of the total population, yet represent nearly 10% of missing Americans, according to the Crime Information Center. Native American women represent about 1.3% of the total population, according to that same article, Information Center. When Finclea disappeared, the Black and Missing Foundation used its social media platform to raise awareness about her, said Natalie Wilson, co-founder and director of public relations. The foundation provided support for her mother, Amanda Costa. Oftentimes, she said, when a person of color or child of color is reported missing, they're classified as a runaway. If you're classified as a runaway, you do not receive the Amber Alert or any type of media coverage, Wilson said. And awareness is key in finding our missing. After Finclea went missing, for example, rumors raged on social media platforms and blogs reporting that she had run away. People of color who go missing are often deemed as being involved in criminal activity, Wilson said, and therefore they're not deemed worthy enough to be found. Mm-hmm. For instance, before 11 women were found on the property of serial killer Anthony Sowell in Cleveland in 2009, when families went to law enforcement asking for help for their loved ones, they were told that women were on drugs or just ran away. And they really failed to do anything to find them. The case of Christopher Lewis also sticks out in Wilson's mind. At 13 years old, he disappeared in 2014 from Boston after getting off of a school bus. He never made it home. And he's never been found. When a person of color disappears, people get the assumption that they must have done something to deserve it, said Megan Good, founder of the Charlie Project, a website that publicizes cold missing persons cases across the country. It is especially true with black men, Good said. They are among the most common demographic of missing adults, but they are often never covered in news. Wealth and social status also play a role in finding people, Good said. When Elizabeth Smart was kidnapped in Utah in 2002, for instance, her father was able to hire a publicist, and she was eventually found after a stranger recognized her at a fast food restaurant. I also remember just randomly right now that a wealthy family, like their son went missing. This is random. And apparently their son had gone off in a ravine, like driving, and the dad was able to hire a personal helicopter to go look for this person and found him, you know, where otherwise he would have died out there. But if a family member of an immigrant family who does not speak English goes missing, they may not have the resources to publicize the case. Falmouth Police Chief Edward Dune, president of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association, said he does not think that race plays a role in how police in Massachusetts investigate a person's case. Does he? Police departments try to find as much information as possible, he said. They enter the missing person into national databases, follow up on leads, but sometimes people associated with the missing person do not want to talk with them, such as if they have a criminal background, at some point, police run out of leads and cases go cold. So he's saying that basically people of color, friends and background and family are way more criminal, and this is why they're not speaking up. Well, actually, what probably the reality is that he's a police officer. They're afraid of him, and they don't want to go down a rabbit hole where they might be all of a sudden whisked off to jail because they said something wrong or, you know, even if it had nothing to do with it, you know. I get that, so I don't really agree here. Still, cases involving African Americans remain open and unresolved 4 times longer than cases involving white and Hispanic people, according to the College of William and Mary. I can't believe I missed this when I read this article. That's my alma mater.
I was going to say, yeah.
They, according to College of William and Mary, who published this in 2019. Oh, look at that. Okay. Blacks,
thank you, William and Mary.
Thank you, William and Mary, both who were undeniably racist.
it's in Virginia, not surprising.
Quink antidote. Antidote? No. Anecdote.
Okay.
Quick antidote. Quick anecdote. The College of William and Mary was originally a school for training natives to behave, and that didn't go over well. They escaped. They killed people. Then they were like, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. Hey, you know, why don't we make this like that college that opened up in Massachusetts? You mean Harvard? Okay. Yeah, let's try to become Harvard. And that's literally how it happened. And that's how we have College of William & Mary today. Okay.
Wow.
Blacks.
The more you know.
I know. The more you know. Blacks, on average, remain missing longer and are more likely to be still missing at the end of our observation period than non-black children. According to the study by a U.S. National Library of Medicine and National Institutes of Health published in 2018, the study concluded that the greater media attention is towards missing white girls receive much aided search efforts, whereas resources available for search efforts involving black children are more limited, non-existent, and the law enforcement may put more effort into cases involving missing white boys. I mean, also, you want to say, like, if you're, you know, XYZ police department, it's harder to close those cases. It's easier to close these cases. I need to close cases, right? And that's just the unfortunate, the way police work, the way the system work. You know, it could very well be a fully well-intentional officer or well-intentioned police department, but you know, you're going to rack up points, basically, you know, is what you're trying to do. And I know that I'm going to get probably a better head start if I start investigating this white girl or this white boy versus these minority groups, because you're never going to find any detail. So they believe, whether or not it's true, etc. These mechanisms unequivocally imply lower daily chances for black children to be found. Martin Reynolds, a co-executive director of the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, a nonprofit organization that works to help newsrooms reflect the diversity of the United States, said the problem in how news organizations cover missing people stems from a long-term systemic approach in covering communities of color. Surprise. To fix that problem requires deep, soul-searching assessments on the part of the news organizations, he said. When an organization's coverage of people of color hovers around only crime and violence, or people of color being impoverished, or navigating addiction, or being a drain to society's resources, there's a devaluation that subsequently emerges. Okay, So stop doing it, please. So when a person of color goes missing, the urgency and the value placed on those members of the community are just not present. If we're not saying why this matters to us as news organizations, to our society, and to our communities, Reynolds said, we're not going to come up with solutions that often stick. It takes all of us, law enforcement, the community, and media, to bring awareness to our missing and help us find them, Wilson said. We all play an important role. And oftentimes, these missing individuals are faceless and voiceless. We need to remember that these are mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, grandparents, cousins, friends, neighbors that are missing. They deserve to be found, or their family deserves closure after what happened. The discovery of Finclea's body, while not the outcome her family and friends had hoped for, allows them to finally start that healing process. That's my short but sweet true crime and expose on people of color and current statistics.
That was, yeah, like I said, a little education. I didn't know. I mean, I knew that, yes, black kids, black people, and just people in color in general are go missing a lot more than, you know, little white boys and girls or just white people in general. But to hear the statistics and
forget about it if you're native. Like, forget about it. There was another article that I was going to tie into this, but it maybe for another time. I can't remember the specific words, but there was a tribal chief who was telling, one of the daughters of the tribe, you know, don't go missing or you'll never be found. There's absolutely no dedication to anybody who is native. Obviously, like, somehow, like, native is looked as an even less of an importance to black people, or at the same level, you know, but
also because they are, I feel like the, how do you say, maybe like influence is not the word I want to say, but like, there are more black people here than Native Americans. And the Native Americans that are here, because they live on reservations, they're not, they should be, but they are not a part of American culture in the way that black people or even Latino people are. Mm-hmm. And anyways, I'm just saying this is maybe why, you know, it's even worse for them.
And nothing of it, you know,
America
flows logically, because like I saw a lot of these pictures of the native girls and guys missing, and you know, again, it doesn't matter, but it does that they look, some of them, pretty passably white, you know,
but it also goes down to where. And, you know, like this story started off in Massachusetts, right?
Exactly.
Those are predominantly white spaces. So
also, the name is important. So it's like...
Exactly. You know, exactly.
Shirley...
Yeah. Yeah.
Blascock.
Yeah. Okay. I don't missing. Know no Shirley.
Versus, but. You know, these names that I was saying in this article, which I'm probably... totally butchered, and I'm so sorry, but like Jalia Finclair is so
it doesn't matter what you look like, people are going off that name before they even see the person, and they're making their assumptions, and they're deciding already, they make up their mind that like, oh, I'm not about, because this is her versus a Ashley McMahon. They've decided like, okay, well, we're not gonna put a whole lot of effort into this, which sucks, but that's why we continue to fight for things to change.
And that's bullshit what that cop said. It was like, oh, I don't get you know, responses, because a lot of people who are, you know, in the community of color, they probably have crime, and that's why they don't want to talk to
but also was that the same cop who also said earlier in the article you read that he was like, I don't think race plays a part.
Exactly. Like, he's that same person.
Of course you're going to say that to save face. I think better wording, and again, this is all just a game that you're playing, though, but better wording is to say, I hope race doesn't play a part. But to blanket statement and say it doesn't, it's like, no, that's false.
You know, these kinds of words where it's like giving credit to the fact that
it's a very strong possibility that race does play a factor in whether you're finding people or not. So,
yeah. So, take us out of the muck here. I hope
we're gonna move on to something a little lighter and more uplifting. And if you need a hand when you're feeling weary, when you're feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. All right. So Digo's looking like, I feel like
you,
maybe
when you need a hand.
Do it.
I'm like,
okay. So that first part, when you need a hand, was not a part of the lyrics. But when you're weary, when you're feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I would dry them all. Those are the first lines of this song. So let's go ahead and jump into this. We are, this is an iconic song. Anyways, okay, here goes. Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, also known
as...
Yes, Simon and Garfunkel. If you haven't heard of the duo, I'm sure you've at least heard of one of their many hits from the 60s. But if by chance you haven't, I'm going to tell you about their biggest song, Bridge Over Troubled Water, which, I mean, maybe I'll give you a pass if you're like 21 and below, but you should have at some point. At high school, I know y'all had to have sung this song. So. Basically, I hope you know it, but if you don't,
your parents
tell you
definitely
all about
should have been playing that song somewhere exactly. In the whole life to be like, and be like, what is that? It's yeah. Simon and Garfunkel. Yeah. It's Simon and the other guy.
Right. So it's spring of 1969. Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King had just been assassinated the year prior. Racial tensions were erupting across the U.S. The war was raging in Vietnam, and Richard Nixon was in the White House.
What a time.
So it's... Yeah, tough times, much like what we're in right now. But tough times breed some of the most amazing mm-hmm. art, which is, we have an example of this right here. So in the midst of all that, Paul Simon is working on songs for the duo's fifth and what would eventually be their final album together. He came up with the song's opening lines, "When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all." But he couldn't figure out where to take them next. "I was stuck for a while," he admits. "Everywhere I went led to somewhere I didn't want to be." It was while listening to an old Swan Silvertones album that he had borrowed from the musician Al Kooper. The Swan Silvertones, were a gospel group. It was after listening to them that he got the inspiration he needed to finish the song. While listening to their version of the 19th century spiritual, "Oh Mary, Don't You Weep," over and over again in his Upper East Side apartment, he was struck by a line improvised by lead singer Claude Jeter that said, "I'll be your bridge over deep water if you trust in my name." After hearing it, the wheels finally started to turn, though he originally thought his opening lyrics were too simple. On previous songs by the duo, like "Sounds of Silence," "Mrs. Robinson," and "America," Paul had used characters, narratives, and vividly precise imagery to map national unease onto personal anxiety. The uncharacteristically timeless universal language of "Bridge Over Troubled Water" wasn't at all typical for him. The celebrated New Orleans musician Alan Toussaint liked to say, quote, "That song had two writers, Paul Simon and God. I had no idea where it came from," Paul recalled in the 2011 documentary The Harmony Game. "It just came all of a sudden. I remember thinking, this is considerably better than I usually write." So recording of the song began in... I gotta stop saying Anyways. Recording the song
good
began...
Good luck.
Right? I'm trying. I'm gonna make a conscious effort. So recording the song began in August 1969 in Hollywood. Although they were a duo, Simon thought that Art should sing the song alone, something that Art originally objected to, or at least that's what Simon told Rolling Stone in 1973. He didn't want to sing it. He couldn't hear it for himself. He felt I should have done it, and many times I'm sorry I didn't do it. Years later, Art would go on to say that he remembered things differently. "When Paul showed me Bridge Over Troubled Water, he did say it was for me, and I loved the song immediately. My way of saying thank you was, are you sure? Because you sound lovely singing it, and it's almost like you could do it." Now, the famous story is that he took offense, and that became a thorn between us, as if I was rejecting the song. That's nonsense. I don't remember him having a hard time with my grace. He said, "No, I wrote the song for you." I said, "Thank you, man," and got into singing it. I love how he says, "I don't remember him having a hard time with my grace." Sounds so humble. My grace. Simon imagined that Bridge Over Troubled Water would be quote, a little him. But Garfunkel and longtime producer of the duo Roy Haley insisted that the song needed to be immense. It therefore needed a third verse, which Simon dashed off in the studio. It opened with a message to his wife-to-be, Peggy Harper, who had recently fretted about finding her first gray hairs, and that's where the line "Sail on, Silver Girl" comes from, which apparently people thought originally was about shooting up heroin. But no, that's not what it's about at all.
It makes sense. Sail on, Silver Girl.
That ain't the kind of sailing you want to do. To assist in taking the song from a hymn to a resounding declaration of love and help for a friend in need, the string section was arranged by Ernie Freeman, and Roy gathered the elite session musicians known as the Hollywood Golden Trio, which included drummer Hal Blaine, bassist Joe Osborne, and pianist Larry Netchtel. I looked up, tried to figure out how to pronounce his last name, and I cannot find it. So it's K-N-E-C-H-T-E-L. I don't know, Netchtel. Anyways, it was his Netchtel's challenging job to translate the music from guitar to piano. Paul wanted it to be gospel, but not gospel, he recalls. In an interview shortly before his death in 2009, Netchtel recalled playing at least 72 takes as Simon watched over him. It eventually took 4 days for the piano, although Simon would still think the last note of the orchestration went on too long. So after the song was repeated, they debuted it along with a few other tracks from the upcoming album on a short tour that autumn. Audiences loved it, but the true test came when it was time to play it for the head of their record label, Columbia Records. And yes, we've heard the name of this record head many times on this podcast. It's none other than the one and only Clive Davis, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh my God, Clive Davis, everybody.
So it had become common knowledge in the industry that a ballad wasn't as radio friendly as an upbeat track. So the duo pushed for their more rhythmic song, Cecilia, to be the first single released from the new album. But after the first album playback, Clive was adamant that this was no ordinary ballad. I felt Cecilia would be a hit, but Bridge was something more, Clive told Simon's biographer Robert Hilburn. It was a landmark record. And well, ladies and gentlemen, Clive was right. The song's slow-burning arc became a virtue. Most hits made sense in snatches, overheard from a passing car radio, but Bridge Over Troubled Water held the listener spellbound. You had to hear the whole thing or else you'd miss the payoff. It was released on January 20th, 1970, and a month later on February 28th, it went to number one and held the top spot for 6 weeks in the U.S. and 3 in the U.K. And it also charted in the top 10 in a multitude of other countries as well. The song and album's crowning achievement would arrive the following year when Bridge Over Troubled Water won Song and Record of the Year, and the accompanying LP snagged Album of the Year at the Grammys. The song also won an Arranging Grammy. It also won Best Contemporary Song and the award for Best Non-Classical Engineering. And at the ceremony, Aretha Franklin, whom Simon also had in mind when he wrote it, performed her version of Bridge Over Troubled Water as Simon and Garfunkel looked on from the audience.
Really?
Yes. And what? Side note, Aretha is just, I fully admit that even I don't realized, I think, how prolific she was because I wasn't at that time. Mm-hmm. So as a side note to that is after Bridge Over Troubled Water was number one for 6 weeks, the song that eventually that replaced it was the Beatles song Let It Be, which the Beatles actually wrote for Aretha. And she at the time was just like had her own stuff going on and passed on it. She did eventually record a cover of it, but
that both song, of those tracks are very, you know, full of heart.
Oh yeah, and they have a lot of that gospel soul feel that you can put into it. And Aretha could definitely do that. So the song and the album of the same name Clive, I also have to mention, Clive was very adamant that the title of the album also be Bridge Over Troubled Water. And they were both huge. By the end of that year alone, the song had been covered by artists including the Jackson 5, Peggy Lee, the Supremes. This was the Supremes after Diana had left. And again, Aretha Franklin had recorded it. And Aretha Franklin's cover is probably the biggest and most notable. I definitely would say take a listen to it if you haven't heard hers.
I have never, or maybe I did, but I'm definitely going to, I got it right here.
Hers would definitely make you feel, it definitely has like a gospel music feel, but while also like keeping the integrity of the original, because I think the original is incredible. Art sang it so well. But then, yeah, Aretha just really just, the same way she did with Respect, she just made it her own. And it was like, oh, this is a completely new song, but just as amazing and beautiful and all that.
So I know, I love, in general, the Egyptian look. I wish...
Oh, with the mascara.
We all brought that back.
I know.
I wish we all brought that back. Totally, I love it. I love it when they do it. I mean, anybody does it. I love it. Anyway.
I love it too. So, yeah, again, Aretha's cover is probably the biggest and most notable. It was number one. It was a number one hit for her on the R&B charts, number six on the pop charts, and she won a Grammy for Best Female R&B Vocal Performance for it in 1972. But one other huge name that covered the song that same year was the one and only Mr. Elvis Presley. It said he did it to win over critics who claimed he wasn't a great vocalist. And I did listen to his version in my research of this. It wasn't bad, but I'm going to read a quote by Simon, and Simon really sums up how I also feel. When he was asked about, his version, when Paul Simon was asked about Elvis's version, he's quoted as saying, "It was in his Las Vegas period and done with conventional thinking. He sang it well, but it would have been nice to hear him do it gospel because he did so many gospel albums and was a good white gospel singer. It would have been nice to hear him do it that way, to take it back, as opposed to the big ending. He seemed to end everything with a karate chop and an explosion." So he,
yeah. The thing is, that's exactly how I pictured it. At the end, like, bridge over. I can't sing. I don't know if everybody knew that. But and then bridge. And then he just comes on with his cape and everything. And he's doing karate.
Yeah. 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 With a karate chop and an explosion. So he didn't really add anything to the song, which I agree. It's not nearly as significant as the Aretha Franklin recording. It's just a pleasure for me that Elvis Presley recorded one of my songs before he died. So, yeah, I agree. Yeah, it was nothing special about it. Like, I think Art did such a great job. I hadn't written it down here to say, but I did read a quote from, I don't know, someone from, I want to say it was Rolling Stone or something, and they were saying how what's beautiful about Art's, the way he sang it, is that he there's not even a lot of, there's feeling in it, but he kind of just like rides it, just like a cool breeze, or just like he's just riding the wave. He's not trying to he's not trying to grab you. He's like, just listen to the words. The words will grab you, and then the music will grab you. And that's really you know, what makes his so beautiful. Again, just because, you know, his voice was so beautiful, and he really takes it home at the end. So, but as I said before, along with the song being huge, the album was a Goliath. It spent 10 weeks at number one and had over 25 million sales worldwide at the time. Now I think it's over 100 million. And at that time, it was the biggest selling album of all time until Michael Jackson's Thriller in 1982. Yeah. Yeah.
Understandable.
So ironically, this song is about unbending loyalty and solidarity coincided with the disintegration of a friendship that stretched back to sixth grade. "We didn't really fight until Bridge Over Troubled Water," Simon said years later. That had a lot to do with Artie making a movie at the same time. So when this song was recorded, I think it was around the same time, like Art Garfunkel had gone to do a movie, Catch 22, That was his film debut. And
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah. That's and cool. So again, Paul is the big into music and he's writing the things and he feels like, oh, my partner's gone off to do movies and he's not caring about the art and the music mm-hmm. and everything the way I am.
He's selling out, that sort of feeling.
Yeah. Their frame partnership could survive one movie, but not two. After the album came out, Art confessed that he had committed to co-starring in another Mike Nichols film, Carnal Knowledge. Paul felt betrayed. Art felt held back. According to Simon, something was broken between us, and it couldn't be fixed. On July 18th, 1970, at New York's Forest Hills Tennis Stadium, they closed the final date of the Bridge Over Troubled Water tour, and without telling anyone, went their separate ways. And they have kind of, yeah, really like a kind of tumultuous back and forth friendship as the years went on. They would come together every now and then. They came together in like the 80s and stuff and sang the song together. But there was a lot, like they would come together, but then they'd have a falling out again. And Simon actually is quoted as saying that they have a great relationship when they're not working together. And then, you know, Art went on to do solo albums. Paul Simon went on to do solo albums that were huge and stuff. So yeah, it's kind of sad.
I get that. But, I mean, yeah, that's probably too powerful. That's the wrong word. Too intensely, artistic people, maybe with differences. Oh, yeah.
And I definitely understand that as an artist. I think the older you get, the more,
this is the way. This is the way. This is how it should be done. This is how it's right, or whatever.
And not only just that, but you start to have a vision. Like you start to have a clear, like, this is how I think it should be executed. Whereas I think when we're young, we're like, we give more like, okay, well, fine. All right, I'll be more bendable, and all right, let's change this and whatnot. But yeah, then the older you get, you have a vision. You have a way of how you see things, and so it can become. And if you also are working with somebody who also feels that way, then that is what creates the tension. It can work if you have somebody who's like, they're just kind of like, hey, yeah, whatever. I'm just here to help bring your vision to fruition. But when you also have somebody else who's like, no, I have my own vision as well, I understand that it can be tough.
Hopefully nowadays it might be a little bit easier because the pressure of we should do this because this is what's going to sell and this is going to be the big album of the year and this is going to sell this many records and this yada yada yada, would a band feel more free in today's world to do whatever it is they wanted to do this track, do that track without, well, first of all, they're probably produced, if they're self-producing,
mm-hmm,
without a big record label behind them, with YouTube as their record producer, you know, maybe more freedom to be like, yeah, let's do that. Let's experiment, without the fear of, oh, if we do that, we're going to waste a whole year of production.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to release the wrong thing and we're going to go down the wrong path and we're going to lose our, you know, whereas we're going to release this track today and tomorrow we're going to release another track. Another, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's quite possible.
I don't know. Yeah.
But despite the disputes, the song proceeded without them becoming an instant standard. Like I said, it was in 1970 alone, the song was covered so many times by so many people, and it has continued to be covered in the last 50 years. For subsequent generations, Bridge Over Troubled Water has become a musical first aid kit to be cracked open in times of need. The duo got together in 2001 after the victims of 9/11, and they performed it. They also performed it in 2005, Hurricane Katrina. So, like I said, they've gotten together over the years to do it. Art is quoted as saying, I've sung it 6,400 times, and every time I get a little visitation of the power of a great song. To say, whoever you are, if you need some solace, I will try to be a moment of sweetness for you. This kills me. To be the lucky one to express that, it moves me every damn time. And again, I think not only are the words beautiful and the song has so much meaning, but then when you also put into context of the time and what was going on, it gives it even more meaning and more power. And clearly, I was also reading how at that time, it clearly seemed that people were hungry for that kind of inspirational, uplifting music. Because like I said, after that song was number one, it was Let It Be by the Beatles that was number one. And then you had songs like Lean On Me. And there were so many others that came out in the subsequent years that were these uplifting kind of come together tracks that clearly that was the feeling of the time of like, there's just so much going on. We, you know, we want to feel good, but at the same time, yeah, you need something to kind of uplift you. So that was a part of that. Also, I just wanted to mention that Paul Simon, when he met, what's his name? Charles Jeter. Sorry. I want to get his name right. Claude Jeter, excuse me. When he met Claude Jeter, who was the lead singer of the Swan Silver Tones, that he, the gospel group that he got that line from. Claude sang that line, "I'll be your bridge over deep water if you trust in my name." Paul Simon, then it clicked, the bridge over troubled water. Essentially, and even Paul has come out and said this, he stole that line, which in some ways I'm like, it is inspiration, but then in other ways it was like, yeah, you kind of totally did steal that line. Either way, when he met Jeter years later, he wrote him a check on the spot.
Well, that's nice.
Which was I mean, look, I gave y'all the list of just some of the people who have recorded that song. This man has made chameleons. Millions and quadruple millions off of this song. So I'm sure he could write Jeter a second and third check, but it was nice that he acknowledged that, like, this song might not have been if it weren't for you. And that specific line that you said, because that line is not a part of the original song, "Mary, Don't You Weep." Like, that was improv, so that melody came from him. So
I always feel two ways about that. I'm like, I get the original honoring the wherever the origin is, but as cool as I was about to say Jeter, as cool as Jeter was, Derek Jeter is like a baseball player.
Yeah,
Jeter was he didn't do Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Yeah,
that's not what he produced.
Yeah.
The song that he made that was similar was that. And then, you know, they made something completely different. It wasn't, I can't even say, could it be classified as a cover? No, probably not. Because it's totally different tracks or whatever. So that's the way, even if it is a cover and you took it to a whole nother level, like many songs that you have covered, what's the one? By the way, who she likes some stuff I post on our socials. Hold on, I'll come up with her name in 1 second. Lori Lieberman.
Oh, really?
Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
She followed us.
Oh, randomly, wow! Hey, Lori.
And I. Hey, Lori. I don't know if she listens to us, but I mean, I post stuff on Instagram, and she'll like. She liked it once. Like, she followed us once and she liked one thing randomly. And I
that counts.
Liked stuff that she has posted and she has liked that I liked it.
Nice. Hey, that counts. That means she look, Ava DuVernay.
She knows we exist.
Right? I have a Funko Pop account because I collect Funko Pops, and Ava DuVernay, and I posted the Funko Pop of Ava DuVernay that I had. Ava DuVernay liked it, and so it counts. she's like nothing else, but she liked it, and yeah, so that counts. Thank you, Lori, for the love. That's awesome. But yeah, but I'm not
right.
He said he stole it. I'm using his words, and so I am not saying that, oh, he needs that. I think Claude Jeter should be credited as a writer or anything, but it is nice to acknowledge, especially when it comes to the history of Black people in music. Just do your research, people who are listening. So often Black people did things or wrote things or the inspiration behind things and then never got any credit, and white individuals ran off with it and made billions and tons of money off of that. So it was just nice that he acknowledged
it would be wrong to have denied it.
Yeah.
It would be wrong to have denied it, and it's totally I think totally acceptable what was done.
Yeah.
But it would have seen it as like, wait, why is this the only thing I can think of? Vanilla Ice.
Exactly.
No. Till this day, Vanilla Ice is like, no.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
Came to me by an angel in the night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's nice that the acknowledgement, and also brings up like awareness of the person and everything. Yeah, so it's
I know. I went and listened to the song and hey, great gospel track. Mm-hmm. It's they got the little, I think it was like 4 or 5 part harmonies, and it's good. And anyways, you hear him sing the line. So like you said, it brings awareness and whatnot. And they actually got together and did a song later on. Like I want to say in the '80s at some point. So, again, the acknowledgement is, I think, very important, and it's good. So
cool. That was awesome. I grew up with that band because my dad loves it. So nice. Always present and on Oldies 100. Wash FM. No, that's a 97.1. Wash FM. One Oldies 100. They obviously don't have that station anymore because that's outdated now. Mm-hmm. Isn't it weird that growing up in the 90s, Oldies meant specifically 50s, 60s, 70s, and a little bit of 80s. Maybe, depending on what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. But
now
basically just 50s, 60s, and now it's like, what does that station still exist? 1, 2, is it now the 80s and 90s? Right. I know. All included.
It was crazy. I mean, considering that the 90s was, you know, 20 years ago now.
It
doesn't feel that long ago, but yeah. 90s, we getting up there. Whew, about to be 30. Mm-hmm. But
it's good times. It's good times.
But
I think
no matter what, fight for what you love,
and especially fight for what's right.
Yes.